Okay. Morning, everyone. Today's daf in Erevin, daf Lamed Aleph, 31th page of the Masechta. We are in the third parak of Erevin, and the question is, what kind of food? What kind of food can you make for your tchum? You want to extend your 2,000 amos? You want to go beyond 2,000 amos on Shabbos? You are circumscribed within 2,000 amos? You want to extend this? So you put down a food in a certain area, obviously an area that you can access, and that food will then, during the Beinah Shemashos period, will acquire for you a new Makom Shvisa, and that now becomes your new point of center, and you can carry from that point in time. So first of all, the first issue that we dealt with when we started the parak all the way back on Dav Chav Zayin, Ba'am Chavav Amud Beis, is what foods can you use? And the answer is all foods. All foods can be used. Just like by Meister Sheni, you can go to Yerushalayim and buy whatever food you want, with exception of water and salt. So too, when it comes to your Erev Tchum, you could use whatever food you want. It has to have some sort of caloric value to it, some sort of caloric intake, but you could use whatever food you want, except for water and salt. And that discussion of the Gemara took place for some time. In fact, the Gemara in Chavches and Chavtes described how much of the food do you need to bring over there, and the answer is Shtei Seudos, and what exactly reflect and represent Shtei Seudos. So that we spent some considerable amount of time going over. Over the course of yesterday's daf, we went on to discuss the following issue. And that is the following. The Mishnah says that it has to be food which is edible. Meaning, first of all, it has to be kosher. We'll talk more about that today, in today's daf, that it has to be kosher food. But also, it has to be something which is edible. Edible for you? Not necessarily. In fact, we're going to go review quickly the four opinions that we saw together up until right now. Number one, the opinion of what I'll call the Tanakhama of our Mishnah. It's really Beis Hillel, and that is, as long as it's edible to somebody, as long as somebody can eat it, that's enough. So let's say, for example, you're a Nazir, you're not allowed to drink wine, and you use wine as your Erev Tchumim. Is that going to work? So according to our Mishnah, that's fine. That's not a problem. You can't drink wine, but the rest of the Jewish people could drink wine. So that's not a problem. That would work. Even if you're a Nazir, you could use wine for your Erev Tchumim. What if you're not a Kohen and you use Truma? That's also fine. You can't eat Truma, but there are people out there who are allowed to eat Truma. And so therefore, that would be fine as well. Not a problem. That is one opinion that it has to be edible. It just doesn't have to be, you have to be the one that eats it. A second opinion we found is in our Mishnah, and that is the opinion of Simchas. Simchas says, no, it's got to be edible, and you have to be able to eat it. In other words, so if you're not a Kohen and you use Truma for your Erev, that's not going to work because you can't eat it. And so it's something that not only is edible, but you have to be able to eat. Now, the tricky part is, and we talked about this yesterday in yesterday's daf, Simchas agrees to the case of the Nazir that the Nazir can make an Erev with wine. But that's a technical issue. That's because a Nazir can ask a Sheila and get out of his Nazirus, and so therefore the wine isn't absolutely forbidden to him. It's right now forbidden for him, but with a good chance, with a possibility of it becoming permissible for him, so there Simchas would agree that the Nazir can make Erev with wine, but fundamentally though, he says it has to be edible even for you. Then there's the opinion of Beis Shammai. Beis Shammai says the food has to be permissible to you right now, and if it's not permissible for you right now, so then you can't do it. In fact, yesterday's daf on the bottom of Lamed Amud Aleph, you saw Beis Shammai's position for the first time. It's the last two lines. Beis Shammai Omrim Ein Ma'arvin LaNazir B'Yayin LaYisrael B'Truma. So in other words, Beis Shammai is just simply Beis Shammai Simchas' view just a little bit more exaggerated. In other words, it right now has to be mutter for you. And then there's a fourth opinion, that of Chananya. The position of Chananya is, not only does the food have to become edible for you, but if this is going to become your new Makom Shvisa, there's got to be a chair out there, there's got to be an umbrella out there. Okay, I'm exaggerating about the umbrella, but probably not by much. There has to be forks and knives, and in other words, it really has to be a place where you're going to be eating your Shabbos meal. Okay, that is the opinion of Chananya. So in other words, your range of position in terms of how edible the food has to be starts with Beis Hillel, moves to Simchus, moves to Beis Shammai, and then the most extreme version is Chananya. As I explained yesterday, what's basically going on over here. What's the svar behind all this debate? It's basically the question of, when we say that the Erev Tchum is going to become your new Makam Shvisa, is this a legal issue? Or is this, no, this really has to become your new place of abode, your new house? So according to the Tanakhama, again, the accepted halachic position, Beis Hillel, it's illegal. It's a legalism, meaning that we're going to, quote-unquote, ceremonially put some food down over there. The food has to be edible. It doesn't even have to be edible for you. It's just got to be two meals worth, and that's it. In other words, that will be koni your makom shvisa. It's a legalism, but it's not your it's not an actual, you are moving your makom shvisa to that place. That's Beis Hillel, and then each one of the positions gets more and more to the side of, no, this has to be something where this is going to be your new home, your new abode, all the way till we get to the point of Hananya, where Hananya says, you got to bring your chair out there, you got to bring a table out there. This is your new home. Well, if it's your new home, it's got to be not only food that you can actually eat right now, but with a fork, a knife, and a plate, and kli tash mishal. Okay, that is what we've seen up until this point in time. That is a review of basically the last three or four blocks, okay, more or less. Okay, now we go on in the Mishnah, and we're discussing now the following scenario. First of all, let's just give a work with the work, get some basic definitions. Beis HaPras. Okay, Rachman Letzlan, it was an unfortunate episode where there was a grave over here, there was a Jew that was buried over here. It could be non-Jew also. Debate about whether or not there's Tumas Ohel by the remains of a non-Jew, but everyone agrees that there's Tumas Maga and Masa. Okay, whatever. I don't want to get too technical. Anyway, there was a grave over here, and by accident, there was a terrible accident, so somebody with a plowshare plowed over the grave, and now took the human remains and spread it out over the entire field. So this is what's referred to as a Beis HaPras. The word pras actually means pieces, meaning there are pieces of human remains spread over the field. Now, let's assume, just for the purpose of the discussion, that there's no flesh. It's just bones. So we're talking really about bone chips. What do we know about bones? Bones do not give off tumas ohel. So in other words, just being over the bones is not going to make a person tamei, but it's going to have to be actual contact or movement, picking up the bones, which the person is going to be contracting tumah from the bones. It's only when the bones get less than the size of a sa'ora, a barley bean, then and only then do the bones give off no tumah whatsoever. But if you have any bone chips of human remains, so then the bones are going to give off tumas maga and tumas masa. What the Chachamim deemed or demanded is that if this event were to happen, where I had a grave and it was plowed through, and now the bone chips are now spread out over the entire field, an area of 100 amma by 100 amma now has the designation, the legal status of what's called the Beis HaPras, and so therefore, a Kohen cannot go in that entire perimeter. Okay, the Mishnayos and all of those discuss this in detail, and by the way, I'm only giving one example of a Beis HaPras. If you look at the Mishnayos and all of those, there are other examples also of a Beis HaPras. What do we learn in our Mishnah? If a Kohen were to take his Erev Tchum and put it down in a Beis HaPras, that's fine. It works. That's what we learned in our Mishnah. The obvious question is, how can you call that his new place of abode? He can't walk there. So that's going to be our first issue for today. That's what we're going to be discussing for the next couple of minutes. And the Gemara answers this pretty quickly. The Gemara doesn't even ask the question. The Gemara just simply jumps right into it. In other words, there's an implied question, which is, how does that work exactly? Answer, Amar Rav Yehuda Amar Shmuel, Menafech Adam Beis HaPras Ve'olech. So one method for a Kohen to walk through a Beis HaPras is for him to blow his way through. Now, I always have the visual of him getting down on his hands and knees and kind of just blowing a path. Slightly slow method of walking through the Beis HaPras for the Kohen. Maybe he has a leaf blower, but that's a more modern visual, if you will, of the Kohen going through the Beis HaPras. Either way, there is a method of a Kohen walking through a Beis HaPras. And by the way, by blowing, what does that do? So Rashi explains. What it accomplishes is that it ensures that he's not going to be touching a bone chip. Remember, these are chips of bones. These are not, it's not the entirety of a human remain. So the only way he's going to become tame is either by touching or moving or kicking the bone chips. So if he's blowing his way through, that'll ensure that he won't come into contact with any of the bone chips, and that's why it would be fine. Rav Yehuda Mar Shmuel says a kohen can do this, blow his way through the base of pras. Rav Yehuda Bar Ami Mishmei de Rav Yehuda Amar Beis Pras Nidash Tahor. Another thing which would allow a kohen to walk through the base of pras is, let's say you already have a trail, a path, right? You ever take those walks through this forest and you find an already existing trail, meaning it's a lot of people that walk through that path already. So in other words, you have already a beaten path. So I know we're always taught at a young age, don't go down the beaten path. So in the base of pras, no, go down the beaten path. Why? Because if it's already trail and there are already people have walked there, so if in fact there were bones over there, the bones would have been exposed or uncovered, or the bone chips would have been stepped on so many times that they would have been reduced to a shear of less than a sa'ora, and that's why it would be fine for a kohen to walk through the pathway that is beaten down. Okay, that's discussion number one of our Mishnah. How can the Kohen make his Eruv in the Beis HaPras? The Gemara gives two suggestions. Next, the Shita of Rabbi Huda in the Mishnah, which is a rather remarkable Shita, the Kohen can make his Eruv in a cemetery. In an actual cemetery, not the Beis HaPras, where we are not exactly sure where the human remains are. But we're talking about a cemetery. We know exactly where the human remains are. Everything is outlined. There's a tzion. Tzion over here meaning a marker, determining and showing exactly where everyone's buried. So the Kohen can make it actually in a cemetery. Now, obviously, that's very strange. Kohen can't walk in a cemetery. It's not a rabbinic prohibition. It's a biblical prohibition for a Kohen to walk into a cemetery. So how can he make his Erev in a cemetery? Now, again, let's just review for each other. Who is this addressing? Meaning, remember, we start off the daf today by reviewing that there are four opinions in terms of the edibility of the food. According to our Mishnah, you don't have to be able to eat our food. As long as somebody can eat it, it's fine. So, if the food was laid down in the cemetery as an heir for a Kohen, if we subscribe to the position of our Mishnah, so it's not a big deal. Meaning the Kohen can eat the food, but somebody else can. So in other words, shouldn't it work? So Rashi over here notes that, and Rashi over here writes that this entire discussion we're about to have is only for Simchas, because Simchas says you have to be able to eat the food. So so Rashi points out that this entire discussion of the Gemara is Aliba de Simchas. It's going according to Simchas. Okay? So we got through one hurdle, but now the next hurdle is, how does a Kohen actually accessing the food in the Beis HaKvaras? The Gemara is about to discuss this issue, and it will take nearly an entire Amud to try to explore how this is going to happen. So we have a Brisa, and the Brisa gives us one more hint. How is he going to do it? He's going to be transported in the Beis HaKvaras in a Shidatev Amigdal, some sort of ark, some sort of chest. Right? You have that picture in the good old days of how the king would be carried in his, I don't know what that thing is called, but some sort of trailer where it's being carried by other people. So it's like kind of like a wagon where it's a chest in of itself. It's totally encased, so therefore the tumah is not going to go into the chest. Now, a couple things over here just to iron out in terms of how this is going to work. So first of all, the Gemara is going to explain the issue of Ol Zrok, but before we get to the issue of Ol Zrok, let's just deal down with the basics. Meaning he's inside a chest now, and that chest is going to somehow protect him from the Tumas Ohel as it's traveling through the grave. Isn't the chest itself going to become Tame? And by virtue of the chest becoming Tame, isn't he going to become Tame? So here's a basic rule when it comes to Tumah. If you have an item that is too big, it's no longer susceptible to tumah. What does too big mean? So we talked about this in the past. Too big means that it holds 40 sa'ah. Holding 40 sa'ah, that's the amount for a kosher mikvah. You're talking approximately in the area of 100 gallons. Okay, so if its volume is greater than 40 sa'ah, it's no longer subject to tumah. And if something is no longer subject to tumah, it will then be a chatzitza for tumah. It will stop the passing of tumah. So in other words, this Shita Tevel Migdal, as it's going over the graves, if it's too large, and it will not be mekabel tuma, it will also stop the tuma from coming into the shita teva migda as well. Okay, that's a basic yesod regarding tuma, and that's what the Gemara is assuming over here. But now there's another issue to consider, which now the Gemara is about to discuss, and that's the following. If it is, even if it's too large, it's moving, meaning we normally assume that in Ohel, this self-contained ark that you're traveling in only is going to be a barrier if it's a stationary item. But do we say that an Ohel Zrok, or right, literally a thrown chest, but that's just a just an expression, it just simply means it's a chest that's in motion, an ark that's in motion. Is that going to stop Tuma? Well, you get to see this a number of times throughout Shas, and subject to a machlokas. So, Tanami Mishiach Lachus Velelech Mashiach Tevo Megdal, Kasav Ra'ol Zrok Shmei Owel. Rav Yehuda is obviously of the opinion that even though the ark is moving, it still is called an Ohel, and therefore it'll stop the Tuma, the passage of Tuma, and the Kohen riding inside the ark is therefore going to be impervious and defended of the Tuma. Over plukta the honey tonight, and the Gemara points out that it's a machlokis tonight. Detanya Nichnas Artaamim, Bishita Tevo Migdal. If you go into the lands of the nations, otherwise known as anywhere outside of Eretz Yisrael, did you know all lands outside of Eretz Yisrael is Tameh? Rabbinically, but still, nevertheless, it's going to be Tameh. And so now the Kohen's traveling outside of Eretz Yisrael, but he's being transported in Shita Tevo Migdal. So Rabbi Mitameh, Rabbi Yosef, Rabbi Yehuda Mitaher. So Machlokas Tanayim, whether or not the Kohen is going to be Tameh or Tahor. Mimaika Miflagi, Marsava Ol Zrok Lav Shmei Ohel, Umarsava Ol Zrok Shmei Ohel. The Gemara says this is exactly the Machlokas. Whether or not an Ohel that's moving still has the status of an Ohel or no. An Ohel, by its very nature, its very definition, has to be a stationary object, a permanent object, an immobile object. Then and only then does it have the status of Ohel. If you're of the opinion that Ohel Zrok is considered an Ohel, so then you're good. Then you're going to be protected. Then it serves as a barrier. If Ohel Zrok is Lav Shmei Ohel, there's nothing that is separating from you and the Tuma, and you're going to be subject to being Tameh. Our Mishnah that talks about the Erev for the Kohen being placed in the graveyard, how can the Kohen get there? So, in a Shita Teva Migdal, how does that work? Rav Yehuda must be subscribing to the viewpoint that Ohel Zrok Shmei Ohel.
How can it be moved on Shabbat?
How can you move it on Shabbos? So, if the if it's an enclosed area, meaning let's say the graveyard's enclosed, there's a fence around it, so now it's a Rosh Hashanah. So, yeah, so in other words, it's the enclosure is greater than the actual graveyard itself. A Kohen can go, you know, can be approximate to the graveyard. He can be actually on top of the graveyard. There is an Issa de Rabbanan for a Kohen to be, if let's say you know exactly where the grave is marked, there's an Issa de Rabbanan for the Kohen to be within 4 amos of that grave. Okay, so in other words, but the enclosure is a much wider area, so he could be inside the enclosure and still not be within 4 amos of any particular grave. Okay, v'hadetanya Rav Yehuda Omer ma'arvin l'kohen tahor b'truma tahora b'kever. So hechiyaz also the Gemara says, and now that we have all this information, now we're going to quote a brisa, but we're going to be totally comfortable with the brisa. The brisa says that according to Rav Yehuda, a kohen, we're going to up the antes over here. A kohen can make his eruv in a graveyard using truma. Now, we know that the halacha is once truma becomes tameh, that's it. Kohen is not allowed to eat it. Once a kohen becomes tameh, he can't eat truma. And it goes without saying that if the kohen and the truma are tameh, obviously the kohen can't eat the truma. But there is a way to maintain the integrity of the truma even as the truma sits in the graveyard. And more than that is that you can take the truma, put it in the graveyard, have the kohen come to the graveyard and eat the truma, and everything would be fine. Now, the hechi azel, so the Gemara asks the obvious question now, but how is he going to get into the graveyard? But we now know the answer already. B'shita tevo migdal, he goes inside of an ark. V'hakeven da'achta itmele, so the Gemara says, okay, how did the truma get into the graveyard? Meaning, if they put down the truma in the graveyard, isn't the truma going to become tameh? So even if there's a way of defending him from the truma, isn't the truma just simply by putting it down in the graveyard, isn't the truma going to become tameh? So the Gemara gives a couple of suggestions. B'shalah hukshara. Maybe the truma never comes into contact with liquid. We know the halacha is that a food only becomes tamei first if it's mukhshar lekabel tuma. It's got to come into contact with one of the seven liquids. This particular truma question never comes into contact with the seven liquids. So, for example, let's say it's grapes, but the grapes never came into contact with water. So these are grapes which are impervious to truma because there's low hukshar lekabel. That's one suggestion. Another one, shenilo shebemei peros. Or let's say it's bread. What do we use to knead the bread? Not water. May peros. We use fruit juice. Fruit juice is not one of the seven liquids. So although the flour used to make this bread is truma flour, it was kneaded with may peros. I guess you can argue you can make a mizonos on this, on it. But the but it was nilosh with may peros, which means that never came into contact with water. Again, it's the same basic point. It's never mukhshar lekabel truma. Okay? Vehechi maisile. Next hurdle that we got to get over is how is the Kohen going to reach out and get his truma? So now we have the picture. Let me paint the picture. I have now the truma sitting in the graveyard. The truma does not become tummy because it's lohukshur lekabel tuma. The Kohen now is traveling in the graveyard to get to it. How is he doing that? He's riding in an ark. So far, so good. There's one small problem, which is, how is the Kohen going to reach out in order to get his truma? Now, I guess the simplest suggestion would be have somebody else pick it up and bring it inside to the Ark of the Kohen, where the Kohen's inside of. That's a simple suggestion. The Gemara would like to know, is there a way of him actually getting the truma? And the Gemara says, yes, there is. V'hechi maisi la, b'pshutei kli eitz delo mekabel tuma. So he takes a wooden stick and he uses it to fetch, to pierce the truma. Now, pshute kliyetz, we know the halacha is that wood, in order for wood to be mekabel truma, it has to be A, kli, B, a kli with a toch. It has to have some sort of inside. It has to be a receptacle. If it's pshute kliyetz, if it's, let's say, a 2x4 piece of wood, that minatara is not going to be mekabel tuma, and it sounds from our Gemara over here, even midrabanan, it's not going to be mekabel tuma, and I see Tosfos discusses that very issue. But either way, in other words, pshute kliyetz is impervious to tuma, so that's how the Kohen can get his truma. V'hakama'ahil, the Gemara says, here's our issue. Okay, the pshute kliyetz is not going to be mekabel tuma. But if you could just imagine, right, with a little bit of imagination, if this is, let's say, my pshute kliyetz, I know it's a tissue box, but if this was pshute kliyetz, and I, the Kohen, took it out of the ark, his hand stayed inside of the ark, but took it out of the ark in order to get his truma that's in the graveyard, so isn't this now going to be over the graveyard, which now means the following. The truma goes up, spreads out underneath, and travels up the pshute kliyetz, and obviously he's going to hit his hand. So isn't that going to happen? So the Gemara, this is what's called the ma'ahil, where the item itself serves as a cover, and therefore is going to spread the tumah. V'hakamayil d'maisi le'achorei. So the Gemara gives a somewhat of a cryptic answer. Maisi le'achorei, he holds it from the back. What exactly does that mean? First of all, Rashi has another possible girsa, which is maisi le'achudei. Rashi writes, the klisha ein b'chudo, tefach lav olhu. The particular kli in question is not a wide-based kli of a tefach, like our tissue box over here, but the pshute kliyetz was something a lot thinner, let's say like this pen, although this pen is not made out of wood, but in other words, it's a much thinner item, and it will not be ma'ahil. The only things that will be ma'ahil are things that are only a tefach wide, and this is not a tefach wide. Tolo mekabli tuma. V'haka, I hachi my time of the rabbanan. Okay, now, good. We have now basically jumped over every single hurdle. How can the Kohen make his Eruv in a graveyard, in a cemetery? So the answer is, everything we just talked about. He's riding in an ark. The ark serves as a way of protecting him. The ark is greater than 40 saw. The ark itself is not going to become tummy, and it'll be a chatzitza for the tum itself. Rav Yehuda is of the opinion that Ol Zrok Shmei Ohel. How is the truma sitting out there in the graveyard? answer again, the truma is not mekabel tuma, it's not mukhsha lekabel tuma, therefore the truma is not going to be mekabel tuma. How is he actually stabbing his food to bring it inside the ark? Using pshute kli eitz that's less than a tefach wide. Okay, good. Now that we have jumped every hurdle, so now that's all Shitas Rabbi Yehuda. Obviously, the Chachamim disagree. So the obvious question is, why do the Chachamim disagree? And the Rabbana and Kasavri also knows bias be Suriana. So the Chachamim say because you're now benefiting from a graveyard, meaning by making an Eruv in a graveyard, you're now gaining for yourself passage and ability to walk more than 2,000 amos. So that means that you're personally benefiting from a graveyard. Now we know as a basic rule in halacha that you're not allowed to benefit from a mace. So how can you put down your Eruv inside the graveyard and get any benefit from the graveyard? A mace is asr bahana. You're not allowed to benefit from the graveyard. Now, the Gemara says, Mechlal Rav Yehuda Sever Mutar. So, and that means, so now that we hear the position of the Chachamim, so now we turn back to Rav Yehuda. Rav Yehuda, you're telling me that it's okay to get benefit from a graveyard? Kasavra mitzvos lav lehenos nitnu. So the Gemara says, well, you know what Rav Yehuda will argue? Look, and we made this point yesterday, and we're going to make it again today. Why are we making an Erev on Shabbos? An Erev Tchum on Shabbos? So, we're going to see that the basic position of the Gemara is that I can only make an Erev Tchum for the purposes of a mitzvah. Meaning, before Shabbos I hear that there's a kala on the that's across the ways. That the only way I'm going to be able to walk there in Shabbos is by setting up my Erev Tchum. And I want to be Mesameach Chasam Mekala. Or there's an Aval. Or there's a Shir that's being given over there. So, for any mitzvah opportunity, I can make an Erev Tchum. We have a general rule in halacha, mitzvahs lav lehenas nitnu, that although there is spiritual benefit from doing a mitzvah, but nevertheless, there is no, any benefit that you get cannot fall under the category of hana. Meaning, hana is a real physical benefit that you receive. So here we have a general rule of mitzvahs lav lehenas nitnu. So the only reason why I'm setting up an Erev is to do a mitzvah, and that can't be called a hana'a, that isn't called a hana'a, and so therefore I'm not violating the rule of getting benefit from a cemetery because it's not a hana'a.
When is Shabbat?
Huh? What, just the walking, the walk itself?
You know your mitzvah on Shabbat, you're getting hana'a from the benefit.
Yeah, but I'm making it only for the mitzvah. In other words, we're looking at the goal. Because the goal of making it is to do a mitzvah, so the whole thing is considered a mitzvah. Although, stay tuned, because you're going to see your point will come into play in just a moment. So the Gemara says, well, that really puts Rava in a sticky spot. Because Rava says, mitzvah lav lehenas nitnu. No, Rava's an Amora. So now basically what you're telling me is that we hear this from Rava time and again. We heard it from him in Rosh Hashanah. Actually, we will hear it from him in Rosh Hashanah. But it puts him in a tricky spot because that means that his position of mitzvah lav lehenas nitnu. You mean to tell me that's really a machlokes tanaim? And you mean to tell me that he only is relegated now to the opinion of Rabbi Yehuda? And the Chachamim argue with Rabbi Yehuda? That's uncomfortable. So the lemakit tanai amr l'shmaitei? So Rava says, look, no. Everyone agrees with me. Mitzvah's lav lehenas nitnu, that when you benefit from the mitzvah, that's not called the hana, that's not called the benefit. Again, there's spiritual reward, obviously, but that's not considered an actual hana. And everybody agrees with that, Rava, both Rav Yehuda and the Chachamim. What's that issue over here is, what will justify a person making an Erev Tchum? According to Rav Yehuda, you can only make an Erev Tchum for the purpose of a mitzvah. Hachnas is chasam mekala, ashir, avelus, bikur cholim. You can only make an Erev Tchum only for the purpose of a mitzvah. So therefore, it will never be a problem for a Kohen to make his Erev Tchum in a cemetery, even though he's benefiting from the cemetery. But the only reason why he's making the Erev Tchum, the only allowance for him to make an Erev Tchum is only for the purpose of a mitzvah. Meanwhile, the Chachamim disagree. The Chachamim say, no, you can make an Erev Tchum even if it's not for a Dvar Mitzvah. If you, for whatever reason, have the inclination that you want to go to a certain place, you can make your Erev Tchum, even though there's no mitzvah, it's just simply, I want to walk there. you can still make an Erev Tchum. Now, according to the Chachamim, you're doing it for Dvar Rishus, and now you're putting up your Erev Tchum in a cemetery. Now you're benefiting from the cemetery. That's no good. So so Rava will tell you that's the machlokes between the Chacham and Rav Yehuda, but everybody agrees to the principle of mitzvos lav lahenos ninu. Elahadam Rav Yosef and Marvin Ladvar mitzvah lema ketanai amr l'shmaitai. Now you're putting Rav Yosef in an uncomfortable position. Rav Yosef is of the opinion, we're going to see this much later in the Masechta, that you can only make an Erev Tchum only for the purpose of mitzvah. Now you're putting Rav Yosef on an island, Rav Yehuda Island, meaning now you want to tell me that his position is only really supported by Rav Yehuda and not by the Chachamim. So Amalecha Rav Yosef dekulei amayin maravin ala dvar mitzvah. So Rav Yosef will tell you no. What I will tell you is that according to everybody, you can only make an error for the purposes of a mitzvah and not for a dvar rishus. Udekulei amayin mitzvah zav lehenos netnu. And Rav Yosef also does not want to step on the toes of Rava. Everyone also agrees that there is no issue of benefiting from a mitzvah. So now, if you can only put up an eruv for a mitzvah, and mitzvahs lav lahenos nitnu, so how can we have a debate? Meaning, shouldn't everybody therefore agree that you could set up your eruv in a cemetery? So, over hakamiflagi, and now, Ben, we get to your issue. Mar sarve kemet kana le eruv lo nichale de mintere, o mar sarve nichale de mintere, di itzarech achale. And now the issue becomes the following. Look, the purpose of me putting down the food is so that that becomes my new makom shvisa. Okay, when is it effectuated? We've said this already a number of times. Binash mashos. Meaning during the twilight period of Friday afternoon, because now my food is sitting in a particular area, so it's at that point in time now that it will become my new makom shvisa. Let's say 5 minutes after tzeis, somebody comes and takes some food away. Is that going to affect my makom shvisa? Not at all. Meaning because once on Friday afternoon, once during the twilight period, it was there, it kicked in, that becomes now my new makom shvisa, regardless of whether the food remains there or does not remain there. Now the issue becomes the following, explains Rav Yosef. Now that basically it worked, and I have a new makom shvisa now as Shabbos has begun, do I care about that food anymore? Does that food interest me at all? So Rav Yehuda will argue, don't care. Well, anything that happens to the food after that point in time, whatever. It's there, it's not there, I really don't care. And so now, if I don't care, so I'm not getting hana from that food. If it's there or if it's not there, it's all the same to me. It acquired my new makom shvisa. The only reason why I put it up there to begin with is because of a mitzvah. I needed to go over there for the purpose of a bikur cholim or whatever conceivable mitzvah we could think of. But now that Shabbos has come, I don't care about the food anymore. The Chachamim will argue and say, no, you still care about that food. Because think about it, you're walking in that direction anyway. Wouldn't it be great if right on the way you had a little bit of a snack and you did set up a snack? You set up your Erev Tchum. So the Chachamim will argue, you still care about that food even after Shabbos has come. So even though the mitzvah aspect of the Erev has now worked, but there's another aspect, which is just a simple, though I'll say it the way Ben said it, simple aspect of Oneg Shabbos. You're going to get to the cemetery. The food's right there. Delicious. And so I'll be eating the food. That's definitely a hana. So the issue over here between the Tanakam and Rav Yehuda about putting an Erev up in a cemetery is not during the Benesh Mashos period where it's kona for you. According to everybody, that's fine. It's after the fact. Do I still want the food over there so that tomorrow when I walk here, I'm going to be able to eat the food? According to Rav Yehuda, I could care less, which means there's no hana issue. And according to the Chachamim, no, I do care. And I do want the food. And so therefore, there'd be a violation of getting benefit from a cemetery. That is the final analysis. So, some concluding points of this discussion over here. First of all the obstacles of how the Kohen can make his Erev in the cemetery. So the Gemara went through all the solutions in terms of how it could happen. The issues in terms of why are you allowed to set up an Erev Tchum really comes out that, certainly according to Rava, and it seems like the Gemara is now final analysis, you can only set up an Erev Tchum only for the purpose of a mitzvah. One. Two, even though you're not allowed to benefit from a cemetery, once we've put it under the category of a mitzvah, mitzvot lav lahenos didn't. So then you can set up your erev tchum inside of a cemetery. The only issue is, do I want the food even after Shabbos has begun? If you do, so then you're getting benefit from a cemetery, and that would not be allowed. If you don't care about the food anymore, so that's which is Rav Yehuda's position. So then it doesn't. It's not a problem whatsoever. No, once it's set up a new makam shvisa, once it's effectuated, you don't have to go to it. In other words, it's your new home, but not in a real sense, in a legal sense, it's your new home.
So you have a couple assets somewhere and then just bypass and go where you want to
go. Correct. Which again, in other words, that's what Rav Yehuda's argument is. The Bein Hashemesh period has come and gone. It's now affected for you. Good. You can walk around the cemetery. If an animal eats it before Shabbos, you have a problem. After Shabbos, it's fine. What if it's a suffix? We discussed that in the Gemara. Just don't ask me which stuff. I don't remember. But you could, but that's not the point. The point is that the food that was laid out there before Shabbos, which is going to be Kona. Okay, now, as I mentioned in the beginning of today's daf in my introduction, the food's got to be kosher. When you make your Erev with food, it's got to be kosher food. So the Mishnah discussed this. Mishnah is going to sound extraordinarily familiar. The Mishnah over here is nearly word for word the Mishnah in the 7th parak of Brachos. But it's the same exact point. Meaning if you're going to bench over food, it's got to be kosher food. If it's not kosher food, you're not going to bench. Although, the truth of the matter is, we know it's a machlokas amongst the Rishonim, whether or not you can bench over non-kosher food. It's an interesting machlokas, a machlokas between the Rambam and the Ravid. But the Rambam's position is, which is really a simpler, the easier position to defend, is that if you can't eat non-kosher food and then say, thank you, God, he's not going to be all that pleased. All right, that's the Rambam's position. Another time, another occasion, you get to hear about the machlokas between the Rambam and the Ravid. So, but anyway, but just like for benching, the food's got to be kosher, so too, if you're going to make your Erev Tchum, food's got to be kosher. So we think in terms of kashrus, we're limited in terms of the way we think about kashrus. We think about treif and non-kosher animals and basar b'chalav, which is all good thoughts, meaning that's correct. But because we don't live in Eretz Yisrael, we don't think about trumos and maisros and demai, and in other words, the agricultural laws of kashrus. And our Mishnah deals with the agricultural laws of kashrus. Ma'arvim b'demai. So first of all, you could use demai for your eruv. That already is a bombshell. Meaning, what is demai? An entire mesechta dedicated to the topic, which we don't get to see in the Daf Yomi, because it's tucked away in Zerayim, is that if I buy food from an Amma Aretz, there's a chance that he didn't take off Trumas and Maishos. The Chachamim told me, the buyer, I have the responsibility to take off Trumas and Maishos. And until I do so, I'm not allowed to eat that food. That's called demai. So the Mishnah says that if you want to make an Erev with demai, you may do so. What? You're not allowed to eat it. So that's already a bombshell. The Gemara is going to ask the obvious question. You're not allowed to eat it. How can you use it for your Erev?
No worse than wine for the nazir.
Right.
It's, oh, wait, oh, good.
Yeah, good.
Tosus is going to deal with your issue. Okay. Perfect. So if you didn't understand Stuart's point, I'll come back to it later on. Uve meiser rishon shenot l'chumaso. And Maaser Rishon, where Truma has not been removed, after the Levi receives his Maaser Rishon, that's 10% of the entire produce from the farmer, so then he has now an obligation, the Levi has an obligation to take 10% and give it to the Kohen. That's what's called Truma's Maaser. From the Levi's perspective, that produce that was given to him will be absolutely forbidden until he takes off Truma's Maaser and gives it to the Kohen. If you have Maaser Rishon where Truma has been removed, the Truma's Maaser has been removed, that's a check. And now the Levi can take his Maaser Rishon and make an Erev out of the Maaser Rishon. The Gemara is going to ask the question later on, isn't that obvious? Meaning he did exactly what he was supposed to do. Isn't the Mishnah there to teach us a Chiddush? What's the Chiddush over there? Okay, well, stay tuned. The Gemara is going to ask that question. Over Maaser Sheni v'Hekter Sheniftu. Maaser Sheni has to be in Yerushalayim. Is there a way of eating Maaser Sheni outside Yerushalayim? Yeah, Pidyon. Redeeming. Taking the Kedusha out of the Maaser Sheni and transferring it to money. Kedusha of Maaser Sheni is transferable. You have to transfer it onto money. Same thing is true with Hekdesh. If I have any produce which is Hekdesh, I was Makdesh it. So can I eat the food? Of course not. It belongs to the Beit HaMikdash. Can I remove the Hekdesh out of the food? Sure. Pigeon. So if I'm poed, the Maiser Shein or Hekdesh, so then I could use it for my Erev Tchum. Once again, we can ask the same exact question. Isn't that obvious? Once I was poed to it, of course I could use it for my Erev Tchum. What's the Chiddush in the Mishnah? Stay tuned, the Gemara is going to ask that question. V'ha-Kohanim b'chala. A Kohen can use his challah, the portion of the dough that's given to the Kohen, even though it has Truma status. Kohen's allowed to eat it, so Kohen can use challah. Aval. So those are all the things that you can make your Erev with. Those are all fine. Lo b'tevo v'lo b'maisa rishon shalom, not lo trumasa v'lo b'maisa shein v'ektir shalom niftu. However, you can't make your Erev with Tevel, produce which is untithed. The Gemara is going to say, isn't it obvious? Gemara is going to respond to that. Maisa rishon where Truma has not been removed, Levi's not allowed to eat it, can't use it for his Erev Tchum. Lo b'maisa shein v'ektir shalom niftu, maisa shein in hektish which was not redeemed. Again, the Gemara is going to ask the obvious question. If it hasn't been redeemed, obviously you can't eat it. What's the chiddush of the Mishnah? Okay, now, the Gemara starts off with the obvious question. The Mishnah starts off with a bombshell, which is, you could take your demai and you could use it for Erev Tchum. Demai halachazilei. So the Gemara says, yeah, but you can't eat demai. How can you make it as your Erev? It's rabbinically forbidden to eat. So the Gemara gives an interesting answer. Now, before we get to the interesting answer of the Gemara, you just need to know one piece of information. Although, as I mentioned, demai, you have the obligation to take off Shumas and Maisas. However, demai, because there's a good chance that the Amma Arts did take off Shumas and Maisas, demai can be eaten under certain occasions or under certain circumstances. For example, an Ani is allowed to eat demai. Out in the war field, out on the battlefield, so they can eat demai as well. In other words, it's a stringency that the rabbis imposed, but with leniencies built into demai. So that is, so the Gemara now wonders, assuming that you're just a regular person and you're not poor, how can you make your heir of using demai produce? So the Gemara says, Migu di bai mafkelu nachse v'have ani v'chazilei hashinami chazilei. So the Gemara says, well, you know what you could do? You can give up all your worldly possessions. Interesting. First of all, it's during the Bein HaShemeshos period. Makes it a little bit better, but still, your point is excellent. You can give up all your worldly possessions, and in this case, I imagine you're doing it before Shabbos, but either way, you're giving up all your worldly possessions, and think about it. In other words, it doesn't help you anyway. So the most of it doesn't help you. The home is useful. But anyway, you give up all your worldly possessions, you become an ani, and now you become eligible to eat it. Now, let's deal with Stewart's issue, which Tosos deals with, and that's the following. Wait a second. We now know that you can become poor, and therefore you can eat it. Why is that necessary? Meaning, we learned in the beginning of this parak that as long as it's edible, it's fine. You don't have to be able to eat it, but as long as it's edible, it's fine. So now that we know that poor people are allowed to eat demai, what was the question and answer of the Gemara? The Gemara wonders, well, you can't eat it, so how can it work? And the Gemara's answer is, well, you can give up all your worldly possessions. Can't the answer be much simpler? Meaning, a poor person can go ahead and eat it. So doesn't that speak to the idea that it works? It's edible. It really should be no different than the Nazir and the Yayin. Nazir can't eat it, but somebody else can. So Tosfos gives an interesting answer. Tosfos says that this entire discussion of the Gemara over here is only according to Simchas. Simchas is of the position that you have to be able to eat it. So the entire give and take of the Gemara is only a liba de Simchas. So says Tosfos in terms of how he understands what the give and take was of the Gemara. Which is interesting, right, Tosfos' thought process, because the Gemara doesn't make any mention of that. Meaning, it sounds the simple reading of the Gemara is that this is according to everybody, according to the quote-unquote normative halacha. But I understand why Tosfos says what he says, but somehow I feel like we could, now we could, but in other words, I have a good feeling that Rishonim probably argue with Tosfos over this issue. I could research the issue more today. But certainly the pashtus of the Gemara is that this is according to everybody. Okay. We'll have to figure out a way of how to explain this even according to the Tanakhama. And the Gemara says we're on the bottom of the Amud. We learned the Mishnah Machlis Anim Demai, the Es Ha'achsanai Demai. The poor people and soldiers can eat Demai. Amar Avuna Tana. We learned the Brisa Beishamay Armei Main Machlam Asanim Demai. Uveisal Armei Machlam Asanim Demai. This is actually a machlokus amongst the Tanaim between Beishamay and Beisal. Obviously, we accept the position of Beisal over Beishamay, and so therefore, poor people and soldiers are allowed to eat Demai. So now that there's a group of people can eat Demai, and one of those groups is a poor person, and because I could, in theory, give up all my possessions, so therefore the Demai is not absolutely forbidden to me. Okay, Ad Kan. That takes us up to Demai. Excuse me. Next. Ma'aser Rishon Shenatlo Trumaso. Ma'aser Rishon that was given to a Levi where he takes off Truma. And Truma over here, of course, meaning Truma is Ma'aser. The Gemara asks the obvious question, which is Pshita, right? Good. Levi did exactly what he was supposed to do. And now he could use it for a Zeruf. We know that. What's the Mishnah coming to teach us? I know I just read a lot of Gemara, but basically the point comes out like this. We know that produce out in the field is not obligated in Trumas or Maisers yet. What has to happen is that the produce has to be harvested, collected, brought into the house, and put into a pile. Then, and only then, is there an obligation of the removal of Trumas and Maestros from the produce. Anything before that, there's simply no obligation. If you so want, as a snack, what you can do is you can go out to the field and take an apple off the tree and eat it. You didn't take off Trumas and Maestros, it's not obligated yet in Trumas and Maestros, not until it's idgan. Idgan is the Mishnaic way of describing how brought into the house and collected into a pile in the house, measured into a pile in the house. Fine. Let's say the following were to happen. Now, we know there's a specific order in terms of how to take off Trumas and Maestros. First, you give off Truma Gedola to a Kohen, 2%. Then you give off 10% to the Levi as Maestro Rishon. Then you can take off the next 10%, which, depending on the year, is going to be either Maestro Sheni or Maestro Ani. Good. That's a specific order, has to be done that way. Let's say, out in the field, you take 10% of the produce and you give it to the Levi. Okay? And it was and you didn't take off Truma Gedola. So I mean, first of all, the first basic question, does that even work? Interestingly enough, yeah, it works. Even though you didn't harvest, you didn't bring it into your house. So the first point is that works. But here's what you did though. You shortchanged the Kohen. Because what you were supposed to do is take 2% off the top and give that to the Kohen. What you did, however, is you took 10%, you gave it to the Levi, and now you only have a remainder of 90% of that which was left over. The Kohen was now shortchanged. Not by a lot, but still, it's a percentage. The Kohen lost 2% of that first 10% that you gave to the Levi. Now, can the Kohen go over to the Levi and say to him the following? Look, my friend, you have to give me 10% of your produce. That you know. But because of the circumstances that happened over here, you know you also need to give me another 2% because the farmer, whoever was at fault, it doesn't really matter, bypassed the Truma Gedola. And so therefore, what you're holding in your hands right now is not just my Trumas Maaser, but you're also holding my Truma Gedola. The Levi, interestingly, can say to the Kohen, look, of course I'll give you the Trumas Maaser, but I don't have to give you the Truma Gedola. Okay, that's a novel position. Good. That's exactly the point. That's a novel position. That's what the Mishnah is coming to teach us. That in such a circumstance, even though all the Levi did was take off Trumas Maaser, and he didn't take off Truma Gedola, it still is good for the Levi. The Levi did what he was supposed to do, and we can move on now, and he can use that Maaser Rishon as his Eruv. And how do I know that? Because the Pasuk says, and that's what I read through very quickly, I'm going to reread the Pasuk, Harimosim Yimenu Trumas Hashem, Maaser Min HaMaaser. you're supposed to give 10% of your 10%. And the Gemara says specifically, Meiser mina Meiser, Marti Lacha, Velo Chuma Gedola, Chumas Meiser mina Meiser. Where there the Levi only has to give the 10% and not the Chuma Gedola in the example which I just went through. So Amrle Rav Papa Labai Yachi Afilik Dima Bekri Nami. Well, if you're right, so then let's go now to where the farmer harvested and brought everything into his house. And now the farmer, when giving off Trumas and Maestros, went out of order. Where he first gave 10% over to the Levi as a Maester Rishon. Now the Kohen can go over to the Levi and says, whoa, 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 slow down. You're going to give me
10%. Good morning. We're going to begin. We start with Dominic. We're starting 8:10. 8:10, we're going to start Dominic. Yeah.
I only need 5 minutes, so we're good. So so you're going to give me not only 10%, you're going to give me the 2%, which the farmer didn't give for whatever it doesn't matter. You're going to give me 2% as well, and there the Levi has to give both the Meister and the Meister and the Trumas Meister, and I'm sorry, and the Truma Gedola. So Amale Allah Hamakram Mikol Master Sechem Tarimo. So Abaye says back to Rava. Sorry, to Rav Papa, no. There the Torah says to the Levi, you have to give all the Trumas. Truma Gedola and Trumas Meister. It's called Trumas Hashem. So now the Gemara says, I'm thoroughly confused. Because if it was Trumas and Meisters were taken out of order out in the field, so then the Levi only has to give Trumas Meister, not Truma Gedola. If, however, it was given out of order after all the produce came into the house, now the Levi has to give both Meister Mina Meister and Truma Gedola. Umara Isa. So the Gemara asks the obvious question. How did that become the conclusion? How did you see it that way? Hai idgan vahai lo idgan. And the Gemara gives such a basic answer. Because look, out in the field, it doesn't yet have an obligation, Truma and Meisters. Now again, the farmer didn't do right by giving the Meister first. But at that point in time, there was no obligation. So the farmer skipped Truma Gedola, but there was no obligation yet of Truma Gedola. So there, it's okay. He shouldn't have done it, but the Levi can hold on to, quote-unquote, the Truma Gedola. But once all the produce has come into the house, and now there is a bona fide obligation of Truma Gedola, Meiser Rishon, Meiser Mina Meiser, Trumas Meiser. So now, if the farmer gives out of order, Cohen's not going to lose. The Cohen's entitled to his Truma Gedola. There's an obligation of Truma Gedola. So the Cohen can go after the Levi and say, look, I don't know why the farmer gave you your Meiser Rishon first. You're going to give me the Meiser Mina Meiser, and you're going to give me the Truma Gedola, which the farmer bypassed. Okay, quickly, we're going to finish up to the Mishnah. You know that when you redeem your own Meister Sheni, so you gotta tack on another 25%. So I know it says Chumash over here, but you know how these things work. Mm-hmm. And if, let's say, when you redeem, you only redeem principal value, but you don't tack on the next 25%, even though you should have, it's not ma'akev, it's still going to be considered redemption. When the Mishnah says that you can't make an error with tevel, isn't that obvious? No, it's rabbinically tevel. Why? Because you planted in the pot. The pot was not perforated. It doesn't get a yinika from the ground. It's only obligated Shumas and Maisos rabbinically, not min haTorah, and still it's rabbinically forbidden. That's the chiddush of the Mishnah. You can't make an error with it. Lo be Maisos Rishon Shalom not let Shumas and Pshita let Shrich Hashik Duma Bekriv and not let me mena Shumas Maisos. V'lo not let me mena Shumas Gedola Ma'ud Detema Kedamar Le Rav Papa La'abai Kamash Mulan Kedushani Le. When the Mishnah says that Maisos Rishon has not been removed from the, Shumas Maisos has not been removed from the Maisos Rishon. What's the chiddush? Chiddush is that it was after it was already brought into the house, and Trumas Meister has been removed, but Truma Gedola has not been removed, and that's not good. Meaning the Levi has to take off both. When the Mishnah says that it was not redeemed, what's the chiddush? Chiddush is it was redeemed, but illegally redeemed, illicitly redeemed. For example, Meister Shepado Agav Asimon. That when you take your Meister Sheni and you redeem it, you have to redeem it onto a minted coin. If it's an Asimon, right? What we used to call in the vending machine business, a slug. So if it's an asir, you remember those slugs, right? They passed for quarters. None of us used it, of course, I know. But in other words, but you put it in the machine and it somehow acted as a quarter. Okay, so the good old days. So if you are... if you redeem it onto an asimon, that doesn't work min haTorah. That's not a good redemption, and so therefore you're it's still ma'aser sheni. Rachman amar v'tzarta kesef sheyesh alav tzura. It has to be a minted coin. Hektish shelchul agav karka derachman amar v'nasan kesef v'kamlo. And hektish has to be redeemed onto a movable item. You cannot redeem hektish onto land. The kedusha doesn't transfer over to land, and so once again that's an illicit redemption of your hektesh, and that's why it will not work there as well. Okay, quick summary of today's daf. We finished up the discussion of how can a kohen make an eruv inside of a cemetery, inside of a graveyard. Discussion over there. And the second half of today's daf was, when you make your eruv, you have to use kosher food, and not only does it have to be kosher in terms of tarfus and basar b'chalav, it has to be kosher agriculturally as well. In other words, all trumas and maisos have to be removed. A detailed discussion of what's the chidushim inside of our Mishnah? Okay. Adkan, we'll stop over here. Tomorrow, shlichus. We talk about sending a messenger to set up your eruv. We get to talk on topics of shlichus. Continue refuah shlema for Binyamin Zev HaKohen Ben Shimon Rivka, for Rafal Zaka Avram Ben Yakira Avigail. Rabbi Chananya Ben Akash Amar Ratzach HaShem Baruch Huzak V'Sol Ficha Chir Ben Tzor Mitzvah Shenemar Anaycha V'Yitzim Matzikoh Yagdil Tor Avi Adir.